As far as action goes, the Bible's pause button is firmly on. Moses remains on top of Mount Sinai as God transmits messages to him. This may seem incomprehensible, but the fact remains, the laws must have come from somewhere. This can only mean one of three things. Moses made them up and persuaded 2 million people that they were directives from God. Someone else made them up after the event, or God actually did tell them to Moses. If Moses made them up, this begs the question as to why his incredible knowledge of human nature, community living and social justice had never been utilised or monetised during the rest of his 80-year lifetime. Remember, prior to his return to Egypt, Moses had spent 40 years working as a shepherd. If other people made them up, this has to rate as one of the greatest conspiracies of the ancient world. It's a big secret to keep, and no one involved went on record to own up to the fact that the Israelites created their own system of self-government. And why, if this were true, would God be so front and central in the Israelites' daily life? You'd think that God, or at least Israel's God, would play no part in the nation's legal system if its humans are making up their own rules. Which leaves the leap of faith that involves believing that God spoke the laws to Moses. The Bible is filled with supernatural occurrences which appear to have no scientific explanation, but for which there is also no evidence for an alternative scenario. The biggest of these is Jesus' resurrection. The inability of any of his detractors to show the man's dead body to prove he was still dead is still one of the strongest proofs to many Christians that the resurrection actually did happen. So, Moses is still up the mountain. God is still speaking laws to him that relate to the consecration of priests and the design of the tabernacle. And the good news is that Moses is not alone. God has handpicked a design maestro to oversee the entire creative direction of his earthly HQ. My name is Chaz Bayfield, and this is Holy Bible Episode 24, God's Creative Director. Those of you who don't know, I'm not a priest, nor am I a theologian. I'm an advertising creative director, and this podcast is called Holy Bible, as the Bible underpins three major world religions. So it's clearly a book that has a lot to sell. We're currently in a section of the Bible that contains many laws, but at no point will the podcast be telling you that you should follow any of them. The later chapters of Exodus are often seen as flyover chapters. As in, the chapters people scroll through on autopilot until the Bible gets exciting again. They're not considered hugely relevant by most Christian churches, and no Jews today sacrifice bulls in their synagogues. So it's great that you've reached this far without disembarking. That said, it's about to get gory. Livestock is going to die, and there will be blood. God is explaining to Moses how he should consecrate his first priests, Aaron and his four sons, Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. First, a live bull is to be brought to the front of the tabernacle, which anyone who's seen a bullfight, rodeo, or even a cattle auction knows is no easy feat. The men need to grab the animal by the head and dispatch it, how or what with readers are not told, but the wound will draw blood. The men are to dip their fingers in the blood and smear it on the horns at each corner of the altar, and the rest of the blood is to be poured at the foot of the altar. Whether the beast is dragged into the holy place to drain out, or the blood is collected where the carcass lies, is uncertain. The fat that surrounds the kidneys and liver are to be placed on the altar and burned, possibly because these make the most impressive flame. Meanwhile, the rest of the bull's meat, hide and organs are to be burned outside the Israelite camp. God describes this as a sin offering, possibly a sacrifice to make up for any moral imperfections in Aaron and his sons. Next, the men are to kill one of the rams, then splash its blood on the side of the altar. The internal organs and legs are to be washed and arranged with the head and meat on the altar griddle, then burned. It may not make a pleasant smell to onlookers, but it is described as an aroma pleasing to the Lord. Like the bull and the first ram, Aaron and his sons are to place their hands on the head of the second ram as if transferring their own imperfections to the animal. Once they have killed it, Moses should take its blood and place it on the men's right earlobes, their right thumbs, and right big toes. This may seem ghoulish, but the sense is that the men's ears are dedicated to hearing God's voice, their hands dedicated to doing his work, and their feet dedicated to following where he leads. The blood should be splashed against the sides of the altar, and some of the blood and the oil should be sprinkled on the men so that they and their clothing can be considered officially commissioned. By now, the men will be drenched in animal gore, but they will finally be God's officially sanctioned priests, the first in a long line of hereditary religious leaders. This line is only broken after the Old Testament ends and invaders with no sensitivity to Jewish tradition place their own candidates in charge of the temple. It's not known for certain how the blood is cleaned from the ephod, tunics and robe. In Old Testament times, washing is done by pounding or stamping on clothes in water. Only later is the addition of whitewash, lye and urine used to remove dirt. Moses might now know how to ordain Aaron and his sons, but the ceremony planned by God doesn't end there. Moses is told by God that the fat from the second ram must be removed. This includes the fatty tail, which can weigh anything from 6 to 20 pounds, as well as the fat from around the internal organs and the liver. He is to add this to the kidneys, the meat from the animal's right thigh, and two loaves from the basket, one chunky and one thin. He is to place these in the hands of Aaron and his sons, who will wave them before God, most likely in the direction of the most holy place. This is known as a wave offering, and readers are later told that this is an offering of food which is shown to God during the act of waving, before being set aside for the priests to enjoy. After being waved, the food is to be given back to Moses, suggesting the men aren't yet fully qualified as priests. It is to be cooked on the altar griddle, along with the fatty parts which are seen as a burnt offering. This is a general sacrifice made to God to make up for human shortcomings, and which God promises will make an aroma which he will like. Another name for the altar of burnt offerings is the altar of Holocaust. Holocaust comes from the Greek holocaustos, meaning whole and burnt. This word was first used to describe the Shoah in 1941. Next, Moses is to wave some of the meat from the animal's breast as a gesture of dedication to God. After he has done this, the meat will be his to enjoy. Moses is to set this meat aside with the thigh that was waved earlier, and this sets in motion the rule where these parts of the burnt offering are kept back for the priests to eat. As an aside, God tells Moses that Aaron's sacred garments must be handed down to his descendants so that they can also be anointed and ordained in them. Aaron and his sons are to cook the meat in what Exodus describes as a sacred space, possibly a separate fire made near the entrance to the tabernacle. Here, they are to eat it with the bread from the basket, as this is the food that has purified them and made them fit for the office of priest. This meat and bread is exclusively for the priests to eat, Moses is told, and any leftovers need to be burned. God orders Moses to follow all his instructions and tells him that the entire ordination process should take a week. Every day of that week, a bull should be sacrificed to compensate for the human failings and imperfections of Aaron and his sons. The altar too has been made by human hands and needs to be made holy. This is to be done by smearing blood from the bulls on the altar's four horns every day for a week. By doing this, God promises that the sacred bronze firebox will be holy, as will everything that touches it. From now on, there must be regular daily sacrifices at the tabernacle. Each morning, a year-old lamb is to be offered up, along with 3.5 pounds of finely ground flour, 2 pints of oil from pressed olives, and 2 pints of wine. No one is sure of what happens to the food, wine and oil, but it appears that some is burned or poured around the altar while the rest is given to the priests as their morning meal. Every evening at twilight, the same process is to be repeated. God expects this daily offering at the entrance of the tent to be an ongoing ceremony. He promises to come and meet Moses and the rest of the Israelites, and that his glorious presence will consecrate the tabernacle. Readers are told that this is how God plans to make the tabernacle sacred, as well as Aaron and his 4 sons. Once he has done this, he says, he will live among them and be their God. That way, they will appreciate that he is the God of Israel, who brought his people out of Egypt so that he could live among them. It's an enormously elaborate ceremony, but one which will impress on the people how high God's expectations are for his priests and how utterly sacred his tabernacle is. With all the attention on the priests and the elaborate ceremony needed to ordain them and get the tabernacle ready for service, God hasn't yet had time to describe the remaining accessories needed in order to worship him properly. It appears that a smaller altar is needed on which incense is to be burned. Unlike the main altar, which is plated in bronze, this one is to be covered in pure gold. It's smaller, 1 foot 6 inches square and 2 feet high, and also has horns at each corner. To make it portable, like all other tabernacle furniture, it too will have gold loops and carrying poles. The altar is to be placed by the curtain which shields the ark, and though the ark cannot be seen, God promises that he will meet with his people here. The suggestion is that this will be via the priests who will officiate at this altar. While the main altar is used to burn the meat of sacrificed animals, only fragrant incense is to be burned on this altar. As high priest, one of Aaron's duties is to make sure this happens every morning when he comes to put out the lamps that have been burning throughout the night. When he returns to light the lamps at twilight, he must burn more incense at the altar, and this routine is to be repeated throughout the generations. No meat or bread is to be burned on this altar, God says, nor should any drink be poured on it. However, Aaron must daub blood on the altar's horns every year on the Day of Atonement. This is done to remove any sin that might have affected it through fallible priests who have burned incense there. The altar is seen as supremely holy by God, which is why he wants nothing to contaminate it. God then introduces what he describes as a ransom money, and which involves Moses doing a head count of every man in the camp over the age of 20. Each one is to pay half a shekel of silver to ensure he doesn't die from a plague which God will send if the tax isn't paid. The amount, which equates to 1/5 of an ounce, is fixed. The rich can't give more for greater protection, nor can the poor give less. The idea is that half a shekel is such a small amount that everyone should be able to afford it. That said, when the payments of 600,000 men are pooled, the combined weight of silver is a somewhat hefty 44 pounds. The money is seen as another act of atonement. The people pay it in order to be absolved by God, and it later goes towards the construction of the tabernacle. Priests need to be clean before they carry out any work in the tabernacle, and God commissions a large bronze basin, a kind of cauldron filled with water on a bronze stand. This is to be placed in the tabernacle courtyard between the altar and the entrance to the tent. Aaron and his sons should wash their hands and feet here before entering, or risk death from being contaminated with unclean things. The men must also wash before officiating at the altar, and this procedure must be repeated by all priests throughout the generations. It seems draconian to threaten the men with death if they fail to wash properly, but as two of Aaron's sons discover later in dramatic fashion, God's instructions when it comes to officiating at the tabernacle are not suggestions, and freestyling is not an option. All that is now left for the tabernacle plans to be complete are the holy oil and the resins that produce an aroma fit for God. First, God provides the recipe for anointing oil. This should contain just under 1.5 gallons of liquid myrrh, an aromatic resin that later features in the gifts offered by the Magi to Jesus. To this is added 6 pounds of cinnamon, the same amount of calamus, and 12 pounds of cassia. Calamus is a root believed to have medicinal properties, and cassia is an aromatic bark similar to cinnamon. These are to be mixed by a skilled perfumier with 8 pints of olive oil. The oil is to be used exclusively for anointing. It is to be splashed on the tent, the ark, the table, the lampstand, both altars and the basin, as well as all the utensils and other temple paraphernalia. By anointing them in this way, God tells Moses that they will be holy, as will anyone who touches them. This oil is also to be used for anointing Aaron and his sons to set them apart as God's priests, and it should be made known to the Israelites that it is sacred and will remain sacred. It should only be used for its specific sacred purpose, and no other oil should be made to replicate it. Furthermore, anyone who thinks it might be a nice idea to knock up some olive oil with added myrrh, cinnamon, calamus and cassia for their own personal enjoyment is to be cut off from Israel. The incense that is to be burned at its own altar in the tabernacle is equally exotic. The fragrance is an aromatic concoction made from a resin called storax, known for emitting plenty of smoke when it burns. This is mixed with onycha, a substance that historians have yet to fully identify. Onycha may be the trapdoor of sea snails like the murex, whose mucus also produces blue and purple dye, or the resin from a rock rose known as the Rose of Sharon. Some Bible purists have a problem with the theory that mollusks are used in the manufacture of dyes and incense. Shellfish are seen as unclean animals, and so touching them would be an abomination to Jews. To the storax and onycha is added another gummy plant resin called galbanum, as well as pure frankincense, another of the gifts which, according to the New Testament, arrive in Bethlehem in the Magi's saddlebags. The compound is to be ground together into a powder to which salt is added and then placed in front of the ark. Given the location of the altar of incense, just on the other side of the curtain to the ark, the assumption is that this is where the incense should also live. God reminds Moses that this is where he will meet with his people and reiterates the holiness of the potion. He repeats that replicating the recipe for personal use is forbidden and that anyone who does so can no longer consider themselves an Israelite. When it comes to creating the apparatus needed to worship God, there is a sense that only the very best will do, that no expense should be spared, and that only the best people should be involved in its manufacture. The tent and its contents, as well as all the garments and other paraphernalia for the high priest, must be extraordinarily ornate in order to adequately reflect the glory of God. And the degree of craftsmanship involved in their production needs to be exceptional. Taking an enormous amount of pressure away from Moses, God cherry-picks a creative genius who will be responsible for creative directing the whole project, Bezalel. Bezalel appears to be the grandson of Moses' trusted wingman, Hur, and appears unfazed by the job in hand. It is Bezalel who will oversee construction of the Ark of the Covenant, and he is described as a man who is not only incredibly skillful, but who is wise and filled with the Spirit of God. Bezalel is an artisan and master craftsman who is able to work with gold, silver and bronze, to cut and set stones, and to carve wood. According to Jewish tradition, he is only 13 years old when he is first commissioned by Moses, making his achievements even more outstanding. Bezalel is to work in a team alongside another creative genius named Oholiab, and acts as an overseer who leads his fellow creatives. Between them, these men pull together all the textile for the tabernacle and the priest's garments, as well as the tabernacle furniture, its metalwork, and all the accessories that complete the priest's wardrobe. The workforce includes engravers, weavers, designers, and embroiderers, and the only materials which these men have at their disposal are the riches donated by their fellow Israelites. When they eventually finish, the tabernacle and ephod are both a credit to the generosity of the people who believe that they are contributing to the work of God, and an outstanding display of the skill of the craftsman, which Exodus describes as a gift from God. Without them, the tabernacle would be just another tent, and the priest would simply blend in with everyone else. With them, the people are able to see the magnificence of the deity who they believe is their own creator. Holy Bible is written and produced by me, Chaz Bayfield, with music by Michael Old and John Hawkins Music. Cover art is by Lisa Goff. See the show notes for metric conversions and send any comments and feedback to contact@holybible.com. One last thing, if you're feeling generous, why not give us a review on whatever channel you're listening to us on? Doing that would be hugely appreciated and really would help spread the word about this podcast.